then make your put your trust in Allah, because Allah loves those who put their trust in Him. Okay, so it is an order from Allah to him. And he practiced this, as I said, again and again. Some of the ulama, like Al-Qurtubi rahimahullah, in his book Ahkam al-Quran of Tafsir, book of Tafsir Ahkam al-Quran, reports about Ibn Atiyah that he said, who is one of the Salaf, I'm not sure exactly of his classification or ranking as whether of the Tabi'een or later. He said that Ibn Atiyah said, "Ash-Shura min qawa'id al-Shari'ati wa aza'ib al-Ahkam." The Shura is one of the important bases of Sharia, of legislations. And the one who does not make the Shura with the people of knowledge and the people of Deen, then it is, he must be removed from his position. He cannot stay in the leadership of Muslims.
I have one
question.
Sorry.
Not yet.
No.
You can save it, inshallah, for a little later. When we get to a place. What time they pay Isha here?
Ladan.
Ladan. Alam. What are they calling? Quarter to eight. So. Okay, so should we stop, or you want to give the adhan, or we go for a few minutes more? Wherever is the person. Whatever. I mean, I'll go ahead if you made Mashura with the people in the case of the what was it, at the time of Hudaybiyah, when he was he decided not to enter Mecca, not Hudaybiyah, I mean, at the time of when he made the covenant with Mecca, with the people of Mecca, and
wanted to make the Hajj.
Yeah, when they stopped him, they did not allow him to get into Mecca. That was Hudaybiyah, was after the Fatah of Mecca. He made the shura with the people, and he told them what was his decision, and the people, the Sahaba, were very angry. They wanted to go and fight the disbelievers, and he told them that this is not to be in that particular situation. And so he was angry, and he wasn't sure what to do. And the Sahaba will not disobey their Prophet ﷺ. It was just that they were uncertain. They thought that we are the people who are supposed to be victorious and to be the powerful, and Allah promised us victory, and how can we be stopped from the reaching the house of Allah Azza wa Jalla? So he went into his tent, and he was angry. And one of his wife, which one, do you remember? Salama told him, she said, "O Messenger of Allah, if you shave your head and go out, people will see that you shave your head, they will have to follow you, and that will end the argument, and nobody will talk anymore." So he took the shura, he took the advice from his wife, and he did that, and he went out, and the people, they saw that, they submitted, and they did all the same as he did. Now this shows us that the Prophet ﷺ would take the advice even from a woman. Can you believe this? because they come on saying among people, say this sometimes seriously, they say, شَوِرُهُنَّ وَخَالِفُهُمْ, which means take the advice of women, but do the opposite of what they tell you. And this is not, you see that this is not the way of the Prophet ﷺ. He would take the advice whether it comes from his wife or from other Sahaba, if it is a mashura which is sound and which proves to him or shows him that he can really reach the correct what he intends to reach, or the correct matter in that particular situation. So let me stop here, inshallah, by concluding that the shura is wajibah, is required, and on Muslims, and it is a required from leaders of Muslims at all levels, and that even the Prophet himself has done the Shura, and his Sahaba after him, Abu Bakr and Umar, and all the leaders of Islam, all the first leaders of Islam have had the practice of doing the Shura. And as you heard, some of the ulama went to the extent of saying that the one who does not consult with others, that is the one who is a dictator in his dealing with people, should not be allowed to stay in position. That is, of course, if people have the ability to remove him. And you know, I don't mean to get into this situation, the question now whether this applies to the rulers in our time or not, because we know that there are many problems with Muslims more than to think of overthrowing the leaders who are indeed dictators in our time. But they don't. It's not only that they do not take the Shura, that's not the only problem that they have. They do not apply Islam in any way. And we definitely, Muslims definitely, if they have the power, they should, of course, remove them. But removing them, as we know, is not possible yet, because Muslims are not prepared for that. And Muslims themselves are not applying Islam in themselves. And removing them will cause more harm to Muslims than good, as we have seen in many examples. So you have to be prepared and equipped by the quwwa, by the power, by the knowledge. And then inshallah Allah will open the doors of His mercy and His victory for us immediately. هذا صلى الله على محمد وعلى اله وصحبه start with after I finish with the shura, inshallah. So we are discussing shura and showed that shura is actually a required thing for Muslims to conduct in their affairs, and it is something that Allah ordered. He praised the believers, the true believers, by being people who conduct shura in their affairs. And he ordered the Messenger sallallahu alaihi wasallam to have shura, to consult with his followers, his sahaba, before making decisions in matters where there is no revelation or there is no ruling from Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala. There are many examples, as I said, about the shura in the Muslim history, and we do not want and not have time to go through them. There were many cases in the time of Abu Bakr and Umar and the other Sahaba. But one important example is at the time when Abu Bakr, for example, when Abu Bakr consulted the Sahaba about the miras, the inheritance of the grandmother. And at that time he did not know of any text from the Prophet ﷺ that would give her anything. And he was about to rule against her, but then he consulted with the people, and somebody came and he said, I know, I have heard a hadith from the Prophet ﷺ in this regard. So as you see, the Shura always brings additional evidence and additional information which would otherwise be missing from the person who would make a decision if he were to make it alone by himself. Now, the question is, who are the people of Shura? And as I said before, in a brief way, I said they are the people of the Hilm al-Aqd. They are the people who are described as being able to tie or untie matters, which means the people who are respected and considered as people of authority amongst their tribes or areas or in their fields and so on. Some of the conditions, that general conditions to be present in people of Shura, is that they should be people of Adl, Adala, they should have Adala. Like witnesses, you know, Shahid Adl, the same should be for people of Shura. They should be known to be true Muslims whose practices reflect or display a correct Islamic understanding and a correct Islamic belief. And they should have the knowledge that would enable them to make judgments in different situations, and they should have the third condition, that they should have the wisdom and the power of forming decisions that would enable them to choose for the Ummah what is best for it. And all of this, of course, is based first and last on the belief in Allah and the last day, and the willingness to submit to the commands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, you see, when we talk about these people of Shura, we are talking about the people of Shura for the Amir al-Mu'mineen. And these are the highest authority in the Muslim Ummah. The Amir and those who are closest to him, who are giving him the advice. And then he can choose in certain situations, in certain matters, like for example, he wants people of experience or of expertise in certain matters. For example, the Prophet ﷺ at one situation, in one battle, he needed the expertise of people who knew how to dig a trench. And at that time, somebody came and gave him the advice, which in other cases he wouldn't need. And so the Wali al-Amr or the Amir al-Mu'mineen, can always bring into the Majlis al-Shura people who are of certain expertise to help them reach a decision in certain specific situation. But the people of Shura in general are the people, as I said, who are recognized by the Ummah as being people of knowledge, of authority, and of adala, of being good practicing Muslim. Now all of these, whether it is Amir al-Mu'mineen or the Shura, the Board of Shura, who are usually, you know, for this group of people, are usually people who are with the Amir around him most of the time, whenever he needs to make important decisions, and they are more or less fixed in terms of persons and numbers, except for the people, the experts in certain fields, which I said he would refer to in some situations. So what applies to this Amir al-Mu'mineen, and the Sahaba, the Shura people who are with him, can also apply to the smaller leadership cases of Muslims, because as we have seen, the texts of Shura were general, not meant only to apply to the Amir al-Mu'mineen, أَمْرُهُمْ شُورَى بَيْنَهُمْ. This is a general statement about the believer, that their affairs are in consultation among themselves. And that he ordered that even three people on a travel should have a leader amongst them. So the leadership and the shura have to be done with small groups, just as it's done with large groups. However, you know, we should remember, as I pointed out and warned earlier, that we should not be tricked into believing too much in ourselves when we are dealing with small organizations, and the leader or the Amir of such organization starts assuming a responsibility of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And he expects the followers to obey him just like they obey Amir al-Mu'mineen. And they look to him as Amir al-Mu'mineen. So they give him full bayah. And as I have heard in this country and in other places, that this reaches to the extent where the leader decides to make hudud, to punish people if somebody commits zina or commits stealing and so on. He does the hudud among them. This is definitely not the responsibility of anyone except Amir al-Mu'mineen or those that he appoints. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Khalifa of Muslims in a Muslim state, will assign people in different localities, different districts, and he say, this is my representative here, there, and these representatives are the ones who are in charge of matters, who apply the hudud, who apply the judgments among people, and who punish those who deserve to be punished, who commit zina or drink alcohol or do different steal and so on, or kill somebody. But to apply it in small communities, in small messages, and so on, and give the leader the right of Amir al-Mu'mineen, this is going too far beyond the limits of Islam and treating that ruler or leader, not ruler, but leader who is more like the leader of a tribe, treating him more like me, which is wrong, as I said. I mean, as I stressed this again and again before. So in any such cases, in any smaller organization, there should be this form, some form of organized leadership, whether it's a masjid or any group of people who get together, so that their affairs will go the best way. But they should know their limitation, and they should have it clear from the beginning. You can write in a constitution or in a paper and sign it and make clear that our condition between us and you, or anybody who will be in charge of this affair, if that's number one, number two, number three, these are your responsibilities, these are your rights, and these are our responsibilities, these are our rights. So this should be very clearly stated and understood from the very beginning, and nobody should go beyond the limits of what is allowed in these matters. Otherwise, we will have 100 Amir Mu'mineen or thousands of Amir Mu'mineen, and everybody is making the hudud in his own masjid and in his own locality, which is complete chaos. There is only one person in a Muslim Ummah who performs the hudud, who performs such judgments, and that is Amir Mu'mineen, or his representative. So therefore, what I'm saying is that you can take the picture of the Muslim nation with Amir Mu'mineen and the Shura, and reduce it, make a reduced picture of it and apply it to small organizations, but we'll take into consideration differences, that they are not the same. But we still have to apply some form of leadership. There would be some form of obedience, otherwise why do we set a leader? And there should be some form of agreement on when the obedience takes place, when the Amir has the right to make decisions, and when he has to go to the Shura, and what matters, and what capacity, and so on. And there should be a Shura Majlis who help him to make decisions. And this Shura will not, of course, be at the level of Al-Hil wal-Aqd, at the general level of the Muslim state. But they should be similarly stated, which means they would be the most respected among the community. The people with the best knowledge, the people with the best ability to make judgments and to help the Amir in reaching decisions, and so on. So this is one thing that I wanted to point before I conclude. And the other thing is about about the question as to, you have an Amir, whether it is Amir Mu'mineen or whether it is a Amir Safar, because you have these two cases and then you have all the cases in between. Amir Safar is the Amir in the travel, and Amir Mu'mineen is the Amir of all Muslims. And you have some cases in between which are closer to Amir Safar than to Amir Mu'mineen. Like you are in a community, living in a community masjid, this masjid for example, and people, and Al-Aqd, the people, the knowledgeable people and the respected people here, get together and select an Amir. And this Amir consults with these people at Al-Aqd before he makes any important decision. Now, under what circumstances is he bound to follow the Shura of these people, and under what circumstances he is not bound to? This is a matter of dispute among the ulama from the old. In the case of Amir Mu'mineen, that is, Amir Mu'mineen takes the Shura of people, and the people tell him what their opinions are. So suppose he consulted with about 20 people or 30 people who are considered to be Ahl al-Aqd. And suppose that 20 of them were of certain opinion in that matter. They told him, do this. And the others told him not to do it. Is he bound to go with the majority or not? Is he required to follow the majority? Or can he just follow what he finds to be most suitable for the nation, for the ummah, after making this consultation? Now, there's no dispute or disagreement that he has to make the consultation. He cannot, an important matter, so as you heard earlier, so he cannot just go ahead and say, I am the Amir, I am the leader, I don't have to refer to anybody, like what, you know, Machiavelli wrote in his book, what is his book?
The Prince.
The Prince. He wrote something to this effect, that the king or the leader... The leader should consult, it is good for the leader to consult with people, but he shouldn't make them, let them understand that he is forced to obey what they advise they give him at all. And he would just, you know, it is like something to get some additional information, but at the end he will make his own decisions, and they have no right to help him or to impose on him what kind of decision to make. Okay, this is something which is, of course, done by a non-Muslim, and it is his own view, but in Islam, the question that I was posing is, suppose that you have such a ratio. 20 of Majlis al-Shura say that we are of this opinion, and 10 say no, we are of the different opinion. If the Amir or Imam forced and obliged to follow the 20, or not? Or does he have the choice to, after listening to all of them, to make up his mind and make a decision based on the information that he obtained from all of them? Some say, some of the ulama, as I said, this is a point of dispute from all, and some of the ulama say that is why you chose him as an emir, to be able to form decisions. So he listened to everybody, and after that he is in position now to make judgment. And others respond to them, so this is one of the opinions. The others say that he has to go with the majority. This is another opinion, that he has to go with the majority of opinions. And so he's forced. And they bring the example of the case where the Prophet ﷺ went to the Battle of Uhud outside Medina, after he found that the majority of people were willing to go, and even though he and the older people, the more mature people, prefer to stay in it. So they say here the Prophet himself, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, did something against his own inclination based on the shura. Others say that this is not an evidence, and that so the question is the shura meant to they state, is it mu'allima or munzima, which means is it just for informative or binding to the amir? What he means, what the author here of this book means, is to reach some kind of an intermediate opinion in this matter, in this situation, which he says, before I say what he says here, remember that Amir al-Mu'mineen in the Muslim state is supposed to be a person who has the capability of making ijtihad. He's the most knowledgeable, supposedly. He combines the most knowledge and the most adala amongst people, the most ability to conduct the affairs of this Ummah. So in that case, you know, once he has the shura, we probably in that case would be inclined to say that once he has gathered all the information, then he should have the ability to make a judgment in any particular situation. But this does not apply to most cases, even for the Amir al-Mu'mineen, for the Khulafa through the time. In many cases they have weakness, either in knowledge, deficiency either in knowledge, or in the ra'i, in the opinion, in the power to make decisions. So in that case, the Ahl al-Hil wal-Aqd, the people of Shura, are the people who compliment him in giving him the ability to reach sound decisions. And therefore, in this case, he has to make his best to reach an opinion which agrees with the general consensus, not the, you know, the full consensus of everybody, but the general opinion of the people who are with him in the majlis. Now, here, what this can apply, I mean, even to smaller organizations, that if you have a shura, I mean, if there is an Amir in the Shura, the Amir is not infallible, and the Amir is not perfect in knowledge, and none of the Shura, you know, by himself claims to be, and they are usually people who are of equal or close knowledge to each other. So nothing gives any one of them the supremacy of the others, except that they selected one of them to be in charge of their affairs. So the decisions have to be done in consultation, and people have to try their best to reach a consensus, which means to reach a common understanding in a certain situation to go by, especially in important affairs. And then in the smaller affairs, there should be some leeway or some freedom given to the Amir, so that, you know, why did you spend $5? We need to have shura about this thing. Or in all the smaller things, that would make things very inefficient. So there should be some freedom for the leader, and this should be decided in writing among people, that how much freedom to give him and in which situation he's allowed this freedom, in which situation he's not allowed. Now coming back to this, to here, he concludes, he says that he tends, he attends to the opinion that in the case, instead of the first opinion which says that the shura is ma'lima only, which means that the Amir had the choice to do whatever he wants after listening to the shura, and the other opinion which says that it is munzima, that he is forced to follow the shura after he hears it, the majority of people, he says that the what he tends to, which probably combines the two opinions, is that the person in charge should be given the right to, in matters where he disagrees with the shura people, to turn the matter to a group, hay'at tahkim, to a group of arbitration, to arbitrators, who would make a final judgment in such a matter. So select people that they respect very much, like for example, a group of ulama, mujtahideen, and they say, we are in disagreement about this particular matter, so judge for us and see, whatever you decide for, we go for it. So that's one condition that they can do. The second condition, that he would have the right, if he doesn't, if he's not convinced with the opinion of the if he's not convinced with the opinion of these arbitrators, to make a general istifta. What do you say, istifta? They do it all the time in some Muslim countries. They fake it and so on. Well, they ask people to vote or to give their opinions about certain matters.
So it can fit the referendum.
Is this what they call it? Referendum. Maybe. So they what means referendum? Is this the English word for it? Which means they try to get the opinions of the general people, general public, and see what the general public say.
Poll
people, right? And usually people, you know, they fake it in our countries, in most Muslim countries. They always poll people and they get 99.99% of people agreeing with the hakim, with the ruler. But this is the second condition that he is suggesting. And the third is that the ruler would be given the freedom of opinion in matters, in exceptional matters, where there is an important decision to be made, otherwise a great harm would happen to the Ummah. Like there is a great decision that has to be done in a matter of fighting, of battle, which is, you know, a serious thing, but it has to be decided immediately, and there is no time to collect the people of Shura or something like that. Now he says, these conditions are suggested by a person, one of the scholars called Al-Karim Zaidan, who has a book on shura and these matters. He says, the author of this book says, if such a conditions are agreed on between the ruler and al-hil wal-aqd at the time of bay'ah, when they give him bay'ah, then it is okay, because it is not a condition which violates Quran or Sunnah or anything in Islam, so they can go by it. So Allahu A'lam, you know, but as I said, this is a matter of disagreement among the ulama through the ages. That is, when there is a disagreement among that takes place between the ruler and the shura, what to do in this case. And we have seen this happening in the time of Khulafa al-Rashideen, like Abu Bakr and Umar. Such a problem did not really arise. So probably it is more of a theoretical problem if the ruling is conducted in the correct way, then there wouldn't be, and if the imam or the ruler is of such capability that he is really a person who is expected to have the power of ijtihad and the power of making decisions in matters. Otherwise, I think what is in smaller institutions or organizations or affairs, what I personally lean to, and that's I think what we have in the constitution so far of Quran Sunnah Society, which we probably would introduce, modified slightly but not much, but what we felt is the safest after consulting with some ulama is the following, and it is similar to what I stated earlier, that in every matter of importance, the leader has to refer to the Majlis Shura. And in this case, they need to try to reach a consensus, which means if they are in disagreement about a matter, they need to try to convince each other, which means, you know, everybody has an argument and they need to bring forth their arguments and see why they disagree with each other until they get to a sort of consensus, which we found that it is possible in most situations. There will be some few situations where you'll find that there will still continue to be some consensus amongst the people in the shura themselves. So what do you do in this case? Then you have to go to the arbitration. And the arbitration means we go and present this among the ulama. Even in matters, you know, very important matters, even before we start the shura, we go to the ulama, to the people of knowledge, of deep knowledge. And these we are considered as our basis for shura in any matter, that we have to go to the ulama and see what they say about this particular matter. And then once we listen to their judgment and opinion, if there's still room for discussion, then we discuss it and try to reach a consensus in the majlis, among the shura people. And that doesn't leave any room. I didn't find any situation where this would leave a room for further, you know, disagreement among the shura people and the person who happens to be in charge at any particular moment. One more thing regarding this. Yeah, I don't know about this matter of majority. The matter of majority is something which is, you know, in Islam it is not something which is always, which has a value. The only case where people, the only evidence which they have for majority is that case where, as I said, where the Prophet ﷺ decided to follow the young people, the enthusiastic people who wanted to go and face the enemy. But this didn't say that because the majority, it didn't show clearly that because the majority were of this opinion, the Prophet ﷺ decided to do it. I mean, it could have been that the minority were the ones who would have convinced him to go out. I mean, there is absolutely no proof. And we have other cases where he followed the opinion of one or less people, can be less, one or few people, rather than the majority in certain consultations and certain types of shura. So many people, many Muslims, many scholars do not like this idea of majority. Majority and minority brings voting, and voting is an idea which is alien to Islam. It was not conducted by Muslims. It is a matter of democracy. And we know that in Islam, usually there is a blame of the majority in the Quran. Allah Azza wa Jalla did not praise the majority, he blamed them in many places. وَمَا أَكْثَرُ النَّاسِ وَمَا حَرَفْتُ الْمُنِينَ. Not the majority of people, even though you would like it, would be believers, are believers. Okay, so if you make a general voting and most people decide on a certain person to be the imam or the emir, that doesn't mean that they have chosen the best. This is what democracy is, but this is not what Islam is. Islam is that this is put in the hands of the more sober, more knowledgeable people, and they are the ones who make the decision. And these knowledgeable people are supposed to reach their decisions based on evidence, based on consultation with the ulama, and consultation among themselves in a quiet and calm manner.
I got two things, inshallah. How can you relate, if you can, the incident of Abu Bakr and when the people didn't want to pay the zakat, and the other incident when Ali ibn Abu Talib make tahkim between him and Muawiyah and the Khawarij call them kafirs because they made this arbitration. How can you fit them into both of those categories, or if you can?
Well, in the first case, Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu was of the opinion, of the correct opinion of course, that anybody who refuses to pay zakah, who drops one of the pillars of Islam, is a kafir. And they refused to do it. Some of the Sahaba did not see this as a reason to fight against them, and they did not see how this would be considered as kufr.
So was
that but sure? There was sure, of course. I mean, and Omar radiallahu anhu says, or the reports say, maybe Omar himself even says that, that Abu Bakr started discussing this with him until he convinced him that this is the correct thing. So Omar changed his opinion. So finally, Omar was of the same opinion as Abu Bakr, and the shura resulted in a joint opinion. And he was surprised that Abu Bakr, who was usually considered to be a lenient person, was so tough in that matter, whereas Omar, the one who was tough, was solid in that matter, and he had to obey Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu. So that's in this first case. There was shura, and the shura resulted in a unique opinion of the Sahaba that this is indeed a Rudda, and therefore they had to be fought. The other case of Tahkim, what you are saying, the Tahkim didn't...
Between Ali and Muawiyah.
Ali and Muawiyah.
And the Khawarij call them Ali Kafir because they made this Tahkim.
Right. So what did that have to do with Shura?
And this also fit in the same, you know, when you say... can you apply this to the two categories?
It is, there's no shura here. What happened is that you have two groups of Muslims who are about to fight with each other. Or actually they did start fighting with each other. And then Amr ibn al-As came and made the tahkim between the two. So he was like an arbitrator between two fighting parties. And he stopped the fight, he was able to stop the fighting, and they agreed on certain terms to stop the fighting. So there's no shura involved here in the sense that we are discussing. I don't see it, at least. No.
You said that the hudud can only be applied by Amir al-Mu'minin.
Right.
But say the president of an Islamic country, he decides that he wants to establish hudud, what will be his position in establishing hudud?
Well, this is being done in some Muslim countries, like in Saudi Arabia, for example. I don't know about Pakistan. Do they apply in Pakistan sometimes? They were considering it. Maybe they do it in Iran. But anyways, we know that they do it in Saudi Arabia to some extent. I mean, it's not more to do with some of the hudud, like killing people who are against the government or killing the
Muslims,
killing the Muslims, steal, and things like that. So they do apply it. And this is because, you know, they have an unquestionable authority. The rulers there, they have unquestionable authority as being in charge of the affairs of the whole country, of the whole land. So nobody can stop and say, no, you know, this is not your domain of authority, this is mine. So they are working in a capacity which is similar to that of Amir al-Mu'mineen, even though they are not recognized, and they do not claim for themselves to be Amir al-Mu'mineen. The problem is, the reason why the ulama of Islam tell us that this is the right and obligation also of Amir al-Mu'mineen or anybody who represents him, or you can add to it anybody who acts in a catastrophe similar to this, is because otherwise there would be chaos. Because every group would say, we have an emir, we have a group, we have a leader here, so he can't perform the hudud. And another group would say, no, we have our leader. And then, in some case, this group would say, no, we have to cut the hand of this. And the other group say, no, he did not steal. The other one steal from you, so from your group, so you have to cut the hand of the other one, and they start fighting against each other. Mm-hmm. So this is... This definitely is a source for chaos and for fighting and for further weakness among Muslims. And this is definitely, I mean, there is no argument among the Ulama. There is no disagreement that this is only the right of Amir al-Mu'mineen or the person who can act in the same in its capacity similar to this.
Sheikh, I think we've come to arrive at that point where we want to make it relative and practical to our situation. What do we do? What can we do? Staying within the Sharia, or at least staying within legislation, in our community. We have all kinds of people in the community. People commit crimes. People do all kinds of terrible things in the community. Sometimes they run from one community to another when they see the heat coming on, and they run over to another community. What can we do legally?
Legal Islam?
Without stepping outside the bounds of Islam, what can we do?
Okay, first of all, I was describing what you can do to form a community, which means there should be any community. We have separate communities.
A community here. A group of Muslims who got together to help each other in enjoining good and forbidding evil. Which means in order to be able to apply Islam better. So these groups are separate from each other. Geographically and naturally they are separate from each other. They do not intentionally separate each other. Sometimes intentionally because they are close and they find that one group is not applying Islam the proper way, and so they want to be applying it by themselves. But in general, assuming we have separate communities like this. Each community is supposed to be organized in a way to be able to pursue Islam and to apply it in the best possible way, which means they need to have somebody that appoints as a leader for them. And they need to have a people that they recognize as people of Shura who give the advice to the leader. And these are the matters which have to do with the daily activities and the daily practices of this community, which means matters of establishing the daily prayers, matters of collecting the zakah, matters of seeing who needs the zakah to be distributed to him or to them, matters of marriage and divorce and so on. So there are different all these matters are to be handled by this group. Another group would do the same there. And these groups normally should be on good terms with each other, which means they should be they should try to ta'awun, as Allah just says, وَتَعَوْنَ عَلَى الْبَرِّ وَالْتَقْوَى. Help one another in bir and taqwa, in righteousness and piety, and do not help each other in ithm and adwan, in sinning and transgression. So they have to help each other. Now if you have people in this community who are committing crimes or doing bad things, they stole money from the masjid or something like that, or they hit a sister and try to rape her or whatever, they did something. And they were discovered, so they ran away to another community. You should have contact with other communities to warn them, or maybe to send even a letter to all Muslim organizations over the country saying, such and such person has done so and so, so be careful about him coming your way.
Sure.
But as for, what else can we do? You cannot perform hudud, you cannot bring him and tie him and put him in prison, in your own prison, and build a cell under the masjid, or start beating him or cutting his hand or cutting his neck. I mean, this is not our job. This is not something that we are allowed to do in Islam. This is the job of Amir Mu'mineen. And not only that, I mean, try to do it and you find that it's not only that we are really violating Islam, but we'd be falling in trouble with the non-Muslim government that we are living under its domain in this country.
going back to my question again, and because you said that somebody else, like a president, cannot establish order, but then that might also create chaos because people go out and they kill each other.
No, I said he can. Yeah, definitely. I said because if he established order, it is established in Saudi Arabia as an example. This does not cause chaos because here his authority is unquestionable. The authority of the government there is unquestionable. So people are have no problem of saying that, well, this, I do not agree to this government, I want to go, for example, and follow my own local government or the government of Kuwait, for example, or some other country in this matter. The power of that government is unquestionable in this area. So they can perform that. And the president in that case is acting in a capacity similar to that of, interjects their power among them. Because, as Allah Azza wa Jal says, Allah will not give the power for the believers, disbelievers over the believers. So that is the best way to do it. But if a person cannot reach his rights through Muslim authorities or through discussing an agreement among Muslims and so on, as it happens in many situations, then he may go to the non-Muslim authorities, but with the understanding that he would not forget except his own right, no more than his own right. Like, for example,
no more than what's
what he deserved if he were under Muslim Islamic ruling, which means that if he is supposed or deserves a ransom of $10,000 for a certain thing in Islam, but he cannot get it except by going through the non-Muslim system, and they decide to give him $50,000, then he has no right to keep the $50,000. He should keep only the $10,000 and give back the $40,000 to the person who gave it.
Would you want to find it?
What's the numbers, for example, for a death? What is the number?
Referring to the scholars, to the Muslim scholars, and ask them what are the ransoms or what are the...
I seem to remember when Saudi Arabia at one time, when I was there, it was 100,000 riyal. Somebody was killed.
For killing by mistake? Yeah, I know.
I don't know.
Because this has to do with the number of camels, because it was, in Islam, it was given by numbers of camels.
100,000 riyal is what, $30,000?
Yeah, something like that. Or close at 27.
27.
Something
like that. I'm going back to, you said practicality. Hadud,
right? Yeah, no, we cannot.
Okay.
What is
it? The dunya is not, as we know, like the law, the Islamic law. So, practically speaking, we're not going, that will most likely never exist. If someone kills somebody, the question is, is that person still Muslim who is heinous crime?
Kill another Muslim?
Yeah, another Muslim. Rape another Muslim? Selling drugs in the community?
We can't judge.
Can we say that this person that we know is committing this kind of crime, he should be dealt? Since we cannot perform that, to say that however, this person now is acting like the
criminal. Yeah, so in that case, what you can do, the best you can do, you cannot kill him. If there was a Muslim state and person killed a Muslim, another Muslim intentionally, he would be killed immediately. And Allah Azza wa Jal says this in the Quran that وَمَا كَانَ مُؤْمِنًا يَقْتُلُ مُؤْمِنًا إِلَّا خَطَرًا. There is no way for a Muslim to kill another Muslim except by mistake. They are not. There is no way that a Muslim can kill a Muslim intentionally, and that a Muslim who kills another Muslim intentionally has to be killed. But we are not in the Muslim state, and the government will not kill that other person. He probably will go to the prison, and then he'll somehow find a way to leave the prison and convince them that he was
That's my point. So are we in a position now just to turn them over to the...
Or a person is known to be committing zina all the time, and he's a Muslim community, and the non-Muslim government here will bless his act, right? Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't care about the person who commits zina as long
You know, if he has two wives, that's a big crowd. But if he has 100 girlfriends, that's fine. So such a person in Islam would need to be punished. But we cannot do the punishment. So what do we do in this case? We have to warn people about him. If he happens to be within the domain of our masjid or our area, we have to warn people about him. We have to put, you know, some limitations so that he cannot mix with others and have his harm reach other people, and so on. So we have to act with him in a passive way, protect ourselves in a passive way, because we cannot apply the hudud of Allah.
We have a hudud in Kunar. Sheikh Jamil Ramad.
Where?
That's in Pakistan, in Afghanistan.
But you just said that that's Iran.
They have their own building, you know, their own state where they are applying Islam.
I repeated several times here
that the Amir al-Mu'mineen or his appointed one, or someone who can act in the same capacity, which means somebody who has an unquestionable authority in a certain domain. Now here, like in Saudi Arabia, I give the example of Saudi Arabia, they are applying the hudud and there is no problem with that, and the ulama, all the ulama of Islam, as far as I know, accept this as something permissible.
But that was what the question was. His question was...
His question?
No. Saudine's question was that, bring it back to practical, but we have these problems in our community, and you say...
There were two separate questions. There was a question of applying the hudud in a country, in a Muslim country, which is not a khilafah, like Saudi Arabia. And I said, this is fine. And there was a question of applying them in small communities where the authorities overlap. Like here you have an authority as a small organization to do certain things to help each other to perform Islam. That's where the limits of your authority. But you have the authority of a government, a non-Muslim government. So your authority cannot extend to applying to do it. And there are many other people, if you were to do this, many other organizations will claim the same, and there will be a lot of chaos on earth. So in this case, the ulama say that it's definitely impermissible. In his question, it was about Kunar, where they applied hudud in a state somewhat like Saudi Arabia, where it is a state by itself that is governed according to the Islamic law.
How does the fire go into the situation is going to give you, like protection of the Muslim, and if the neighborhood is such bad, should they form among themselves groups to protect themselves? Because the Kufar government will not protect them. The police department let the drug dealer sell drugs in the neighborhood, and you know, the Muslim women have to walk the streets.
Yeah, definitely. But at the same time, I would say, you know, this is a matter to be decided by the community themselves to see what is best for them. But they don't want a clash to arise between their authority and the authority of the government. And if they go out with guns, and they want to have, and they have a security force, and guns are not permitted in that area, then they should either take permission of the local police, or otherwise go without guns. Or, you know, there are different things to be dealt with. These are the matters which have to be dealt with at the level of the local community. Tayyib, we are late. Should we talk about jihad or stop here?
Jihad is over.
Jihad is over?
That's not useless.
It is useless.
He's tired.
Because you clear already, you know,
I mentioned different ideas.
Defensive.
Yeah, we are defensive jihad all the time, right?
Anyone?
No,
keep that
number.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
That's
so all this is under that physical law. There's more disadvantages than advantages than the thing becomes unlawful.
For what?
Like, for example, one small thing to add is that if the Muslims bought land in the United States, and we decided that we don't, this is our land. And we decided we're not going to pay no more taxes, then the government want to come on and destroy the whole program.
That's right.
So then it's going to bring more harm on all the Muslims and throw us in the concentration camps. Yeah, they said that during the Gulf War they had...
Okay, last question.
Before you know, last is my.
I didn't ask a question yet, you said. You asked
in relation to what you said about guns. Being that guns are not haram, right?
Guns? No, they're not haram. But what I said is that if the government prohibits them, if the law of this country prohibits them, then if you carry them and they catch you, you'll be in trouble. The community will be in trouble. They cannot cause you more harm than the harm that you started with.
Yeah, if you get trouble, let's say if you have more than one wife.
I don't know what the law is. So I'm saying you have to know the law. That's what I'm saying.
The wife can have more than one.
You know, I don't know. I know in my country you can. Used to be able, and maybe in Pakistan, what you can, nobody can tell you anything. No, I'm from Lebanon. Lebanon, we used to have war. I don't know, you might want to cause Muslims to be more harm than what they're harming.
They
have a report on the
Why don't you just talk about
10-15
minutes about jihad reality?